Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Of our radio show here. I hope that doesn't sound too pretentious, but welcome to the Cosmic Citizen. This is Andre Traversa, and co-hosting with me this morning is not Paula Thompson, but someone equally gifted and equally full of grace and truth and all that good stuff, Crystalyn Larson. Are you there with us, Crystalyn?
I am.
Good. Good.
Hello, everyone. Good morning. Good morning, Andre, and good morning, our guest speaker.
Good morning.
Yes. Good morning. Last week, folks, we did a show with David Nash on Urantia University. Well, it just so happens that this week we get to do kind of a compliment to that, something that is indirectly at least related to that. And we're going to be talking about something called Ascension University, and our speaker for that is Bob Koch. Bob Koch is founder of that. You can look at it at ascensionuniversity.org. He also has been a reader of the book since 1972. And, Bob, welcome to the Cosmic Citizen.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here. An honor.
Thank you. Bob, first of all, when did you get the idea for Ascension University? And was it something, I'm assuming it kind of sprung out on its own. It was not something that you had, were not even aware of David Nash's university when you got the idea, correct?
No, I didn't. I wasn't really aware of it, or I didn't have any idea of what it was really about until I heard your show last week. And I had heard about a university project, but that was about it. I didn't get any detail on that. The journey that I'm on basically started with the Challenger accident. I was a consultant to NASA, and I was working on image management systems as part of the postmortem for that, and then later on I worked on supporting the deployment of the Hubble telescope and the first servicing mission after they realized the flaws and a couple of other systems that weren't working that generally aren't in the public knowledge. And then after that I worked on some early streaming media projects and lots of education and training efforts and data architecture. And when the .com bubble burst, there were a lot of personal and professional distractions. But I've been working on coherent information systems for quite some time, arguing that they shouldn't be segmented. And that, that everything that supports a particular proposition be, handled as one coherent resource. And I've been working as a consultant under the auspices of the Experience Bank, which is another venture of mine. And the experience bank is very granular. We try to break the information down into the smallest possible grains. And because of my Urantia book understanding with respect to information, we try to maintain that triad of things, meanings, and values in balance. And where it's not offered, we prompt for it. And so essentially, I've been focusing on experience-conditioned knowledge bases or collections of tested knowledge. And of course,
okay,
that...
Can I interrupt just
sure.
a second and just ask, who do you mean when you say we?
Well, I'll borrow a line from Charlie Wilson's War and say me and a couple of guys back at the shop. I mean,
okay.
this is a whole lot of telephone conversations, a lot of different bosses that I've had, a lot of teachers, a lot of folks that I just meet, you know, for lunch. I've worked out of a home office for years, and anybody that's done that probably knows that sometimes you just long for that over-the-water cooler conversation. And
oh,
I would,
absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
I would drive 30 miles to meet somebody for lunch. And
right.
And we were dreaming, you know, back in 2001, 2002, about this convergence that was going to take place in technology that would make all of this possible. And
were some of them also Urantia book readers?
Yes. I mean, I have several friends that are Urantia book readers, including, frequent guests of yours. I used to attend Mo Siegel's study group in Boulder, and I attended Chris Halverson's on occasion, became good friends with Halbert. And, the person that really probably was closest to me when I was discovering, you know, computers and my enthusiasm for those was Troy Bishop. And, he was putting up massive systems for National Institutes of Health and the General Accounting Office and others. And quite an
accomplishment. We lost you there for that last sentence. Could
okay.
you repeat that? You were just starting to say who was influencing you?
Yes, Troy Bishop, who I discovered through a connection with the Urantia Foundation. I used to attend his study group in Silver Spring, Maryland, along with Earlene Green and David Glass and some other folks. And Troy was involved in huge computer systems. He understands them, you know, inside out. And I was relatively new to it. I just built a Heathkit computer, and I was trying to, you know, figure out how to use it to run a little photo store that I owned. And Troy was putting up these massive systems at National Institutes of Health and for General Accounting Office. And he also was an inventor, and that kind of attracted me to him because my father was a career patent office employee, started out as a patent examiner and retired as assistant commissioner of that organization. And Troy had invented the heads-up display that's used in jet fighter systems. And he'd also kind of been screwed over by the Department of Defense. They said, well, we're going to use it. We're just not going to pay you for it. And, you know, I mean, there were a whole lot of nexus points, I guess, in our respective histories. I have this tremendous passion for hanging out with inventors and hanging out for, you know, with people that have broken new ground. And I've generally sought those people out, and I was very much attracted to the conversation that was going on in Troy's study group. But go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I want to kind of get this conversation out of the abstract, though, here
okay.
and ask you, because I want to ask you how Urantia University, or how Ascension University is different from Urantia University. One of the things you mentioned to me off the air was that Urantia University, you know, deals with the Urantia book itself directly in the sense that they study the papers of the book. You know, each teacher becomes a living paper, as they say. But I was talking on the air to David Nash about integrating the Urantia book with other sources, and then you emailed me and said, you know, that's kind of what you're trying to do. I don't want to speak for you, but basically, there was a guy who called into our show last week, a young guy, Chris.
Chris, yeah, 25 years old.
Just, you know, creating a college, you know, where people study regular subjects, but the Urantia book is kind of woven into the curriculum. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's kind of what you're trying to do, isn't it?
That is, and if Chris is listening, I hope he'll join this conversation because he apparently had a 301 area code, which is
yes,
where
he
I
did.
Live. And he's into global business and public policy, which is also a study area of mine. And I'd love to talk to him about
that. We have a caller from the 301 area code.
Okay. Well, that might be Chris. That might be Chris.
Chris, should I
Yeah, take a call. Take the call.
Take a chance. Okay. Take a chance.
Normally, we don't take calls quite this early, but we'll go ahead today.
We'll finish the sketch as we go on.
Hello, 301, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, is this Chris?
This is Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Hello.
We were just speculating whether that might be you and whether you would call in today. So we just thought we'd go ahead and
Chris,
keep you on
the air. Our guest is right up your alley, Chris. He's doing exactly what you wanted someone to do last week. Started a college, starting a university that deals with, that's like a regular college where your answer book is woven throughout the curriculum.
Right, he does. Because I'm working on the discussion boards on Truthbook, and somebody told me about it, and I went to the page, and I went through what he's doing. I mean, he's doing exactly what I think needs to be done. One of the toughest parts, which is getting the information into other subjects like math and science and how to do that. Bob, if you don't mind me asking, what exactly is it? Are you in your school? Are you looking for like an accreditation? Or are you trying to build kind of an adult education program?
Well, I'm thinking that the accreditation is going to be a few years down the road. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of work. First off, to build an online university, and this is something a bit more than an online university because we're going to be sending things through the mail to people. It'll be the best combination of an online university and a correspondence school. But yes, accreditation is in the plan. But we'll probably start out with certifications for such things like, quality management certifications or perhaps trying to qualify with the International Civil Aeronautics Board to certify pilots who need to speak English in order to communicate with air traffic control and things like that. But where we started was with the taxonomies for higher education and the taxonomies for elementary and secondary education. And so this...
do you mean by that?
Okay, the taxonomies are the classification systems. And in the case of No Child Left Behind in this particular country, the teachers sometimes joke that it stands for No School Left Standing. But basically what it is, it's an effort to unify the data structures that are used for teaching and specifically assessments. So those assessment tests that everybody is concerned about, school principals and teachers. It really is exactly what it's accused of being, and that is teaching to the test. Want to know, how people are going to qualify for this, that, or the other, task or knowledge worker kind of position. And that's an area that I've been working in. I worked in India and Dubai and Oman and several cities within the United States working on business process outsourcing. Years ago, there was a concept called expert systems, and that basically means the computer will just sort of, there will be a screen pop, and it'll tell you what you need to know to answer the question that you were just asked. And those are the kinds of systems that I've been working on.
I want to get back to this. I'm trying to get this out of the, we're doing using a lot of technical jargon here, so I'm trying to get this out, into a practical, everyday thing here for people, the average Your Answer Book reader, which I know is not really the average person, but still, the average Your Answer Book reader who is looking at this site, who's interested in an institution like Your Answer, or like Ascension University.
Sure.
Let's just talk about your vision, okay? Now, I know that this hasn't materialized yet, and you said eventually down the road you'd like it to be a brick and mortar thing. Right now, it started out as an online school.
Actually, I would de-emphasize the brick and mortar. That's a cost.
So let's say,
cost
let's say the online school. So let's say it's like Phoenix University, which you said is the largest university in the world now, and it's online. Although you said they have a brick and mortar element too.
Sure.
But okay.
They have brick and mortar elements all over the place.
Sure. Oh, they do. I didn't know that. Okay. Well, anyway, but let's just take the online part of it. Let's say that somebody, a student is, doesn't matter how old they are, but let's say they want to get a degree from Ascension University, and let's say they wanted to get a degree in, liberal arts. Let's say they want to do some liberal arts major like history. Okay, how would their history major look? How would it look different than another university's What are the similarities and differences? And also, as you see it, and also, you know, I'm assuming there'd be some core requirements, you know, they would have to take in addition to their major. So how would that look? I mean, how would it be similar to a regular university, and how would it be different?
All right. Well, first off, it's going to take us some time to qualify, you know, for accreditation. One of the ways that we might differentiate Ascension University from, say, Phoenix, or for that matter, some of the other, you know, well-known universities that are up there. Take, for example, the...
We're hearing, Bob, from the audience that we're having a very difficult time hearing you on your phone.
Oh, you are? Okay.
That's odd, 'cause I'm not. That's interesting.
There's a lot of echo, and we lose some of the words about... every tenth thing that you say, we just kind of lose a fraction of the sentence.
All right. Well, I don't know if I should back away from the microphone or get closer to it, but in any event, let me try one thing. I'll back away from it a few inches.
Actually, that's pretty good right now.
Okay. Well, let me pull the little headset away. Okay. Back to this idea of differentiating from other universities, which is obviously not where our emphasis is, but there are things that give us a unique value proposition, if you will. Take, for example, the Jerry Falwell effort to Liberty University, which many people have accused, you know, them of being an anti-intellectual fundamentalist Christian university. And then on the other side, we have major universities in this country that started out as seminaries, and the general feeling is they've kind of kicked God out, and they've swung too far in accordance with this secular hypothesis that seems to, you know, guide education, it seems to guide science, it seems to guide the Supreme Court of the United States and all of that. The main thing that we're trying to do with Ascension is to restore the balance. There is a spiritual discipline, you know, intellectual disciplines, and then the practical application of,
that's fantastic,
of that knowledge, okay? So,
but you're still talking about a more comprehensive type of university.
We're
not something that's specializing in just religion or just spirituality. It's really a well-rounded curriculum. Correct?
Well, we're basically adopting the view that the Revelators have put forth in the Urantia Papers, to say basically that, you know, the primary intellectual disciplines are science and philosophy and religion. Now, how you define religion, well, there are a whole lot of definitions out there floating, but I think it's reasonable to adopt the Revelator's definition that refers to a religion of final value as that religion where you ask the question, is there a God, and if so, what is my relationship with this God? But there are people that are religious about washing their car every Saturday, or,
right,
you know, what brand of cigars they smoke.
And also, I would argue, correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
I think when the book uses the word philosophy, and this, somebody really disagrees with me about this, but I think they're using it very broadly. I think philosophy includes the humanities. I think it includes history. I think it includes the integration of those things into you know, kind of a cohesive, harmonious discipline.
Well, perhaps so. And I don't know. I mean, I would employ the technique of suspended judgment until such time as I get some folks on these curriculum focus groups.
I do think history and the arts,
sure,
would be. I mean, obviously, I'm assuming history and the arts would also be a part of the curriculum.
Well, it is.
I looked over your site,
okay,
and actually was pretty interested in the overall vision that you described. I thought it sounded excellent. And I also listened to your recording of the, I guess I would kind of call it a sermon.
Well, they're little, I call them keynotes. I call them keynotes. They're just orientation kind of lectures for folks that are going to serve on the various focus groups, of which we're going to have 12 different focus groups working on curriculum and deciding essentially, you know, what the priorities are and how we're going to meet those, you know, those requirements. And that's going to be actually an easy way for people to serve. They'll just basically be part of a discussion group that is...
And what are those 12 breakout groups?
Okay, we've got them broken out according to three different schools, okay? One will be the College of Revealed Cosmology, which will focus on the spiritual disciplines. And we've named them after the loyal members of the prince's staff. So we have such names as Hap and Van, for example, are a couple of the group names, but we've turned them into acronyms. So in the case of Hap, and if you recall what Hap's role was, you might enjoy the fact that, you know, we basically mean it's an acronym for Heaven Abides Personally. And then we have gone on to define some of the values that we would want to stress in that curriculum development area. And then we have one that focuses on...
For our listeners, what it was HAP?
College of Revealed Religion, I believe. Okay.
Right.
Okay. For Van, and I hope you're not going to ask me every one of the original missions, because we've translated translated the missions a bit. We've taken some poetic license on trying to upgrade these, or not so much upgrade, but make them more contemporaneous. We have a Van focus group, and that will be what we call a values affirmation network. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to try to, you know, have affirming values that are that permeate, you know, all that we do throughout all of the resources that we develop. Ang is Advanced Necessities Guide, and then we have a couple new ones called Mom and Dad. And DAD stands for Deep Abiding Devotion, and that's basically where the emphasis will be. And in Ministries of Mercy, we've termed Mom, and we have one called Son, called Serving Others in Need. And then FAD focuses on the fact acquisition and dissemination efforts, and that's pretty much going to be, you know, the acquisition of information.
Say that again, Bob, because you just broke up.
Sure.
FAD is what?
FAD would be, you know, focusing on the facts concerning the arts and sciences of human endeavor, okay, which is very much along the lines of FAD's original mission, but don't ask me to quote, you know, verbatim
sure.
The Arantia papers on the original mission.
You've got things like the school. Okay, name the other two schools. You have the School of Revealed Cosmology. What are the other ones?
The other one will be called a School for Service to All, and it's at schoolforservice.com or .org or .net. College of Revealed Cosmology is simply revealedcosmology.org and
okay.
Com and net.
And
then we have one that really requires a marketing decision before we select which of the .coms we've set aside for it. But it'll be an institute for management, and right now it's called the Avia Institutes for Management.
Okay. Now, the School for Service, do you think if someone gets into school like that, do you think that would be, like, for example, for aspiring social workers, teachers, nurses, that kind of thing?
Street minister that wants to walk around with a pocket full of nutrition bars and,
okay.
You know.
Now, I'm going to ask again, where would the humanities and the arts and stuff fit in? Do you think that would be more in the School of Revealed Cosmology?
I think it'll be all pervasive, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, there's a couple different ways to look at the arts, and in some respects, it's just the practical application of, you know, promising research. So the research side of that might have been the fact-finding, you know, scientific part of it. And then whenever you get to the practical application, you're talking about a more practical discipline area, which to some people would be defined as art. And I realize there's a larger definition of art. But this is an artistic endeavor. I mean, we're looking to build what we call a creatives factory. And that creatives factory might be, you know, the modern equivalent to the old-fashioned artist colony, except...
Well, I could see somebody, let's say, wanting to... let's say someone wanted to be a theater major. It would be kind of hard to do that with an online school, but I don't know if they could do it. But you know, I guess depending on where they... I guess I'm wondering which school they would go to do... I mean, if they wanted to teach drama or teach theater, then probably the School for Service. But let's say they were an aspiring actor or an aspiring writer... you know, where could they? Which school do you think would be appropriate for a person like that?
Well, all of them. I mean, it depends. I mean, if they want to be a producer, they probably need some management skills.
Oh, I guess. Okay, I'm sorry. I assumed, maybe I assumed incorrectly. When I was in college, you had to pick a school. You had to like when I went to Northwestern University. Okay, and most people were in the school of. It's called CAS, which was a College of Arts and Sciences. Okay, I was in the School of Speech. I majored in something called Performance Studies, which was kind of like oral interpretation of literature. But eventually, I did something pretty integrative. I ended up taking what's called interdepartmental studies in speech, which basically meant I could do anything I wanted within the school of speech. But I guess the point you're making, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, a person may choose a major, but that doesn't mean they have to choose a school. Is that correct? I mean, they can take courses from all three schools.
I think so. We're basically going to try to make it easy to just take a course.
We have a very interesting suggestion from the board that I felt compelled to share with you, that they thought maybe FUD would have been another good Prince's staff person on the other side for the School of Fear, Uncertainty, and Doubt.
I'm going to have to run that by Jim Downs, because Jim, I don't know if you know Jim, but he's the guy.
Yeah, the positive qualities.
Positive qualities chart, which I have hanging over my desk.
Yeah.
And Jim kind of entered into this process, about 4 months ago, I think. And I had given him the grand overview, and he said, well, would you like me to develop some qualities for the working groups? And I said, that would be wonderful. And let me tell you, it was a negotiation. So the fear, uncertainty, what was the third word?
Doubt.
Fear, uncertainty, and doubt under the name FUD.
I have a feeling he might beat him.
As in Elmer FUD, you know, one of the rebel prince's staff.
Understood. I think he might veto that one, you know. We generally had to build consensus through this collaborative process that we have going, and I'm hoping that Jim will call in at some point. I don't remember what his area code is, so I don't know how much help I can be.
By the way, Chris, are you still with us?
I am.
Chris, you know what? Something you might want to know. You and Bob are in the same general area. You're in the 301 area code, and Bob's in D.C. So you guys are in close proximity.
We are. I was going to ask some more questions and see if I could get some contact information from him, because I don't have any, or give him mine, because I don't have any. I couldn't find any on the website that I had access to.
You know, the website really right now exists for the folks that are, you know, that are helping with the prototyping. We're prototyping a couple of courses, just trying to come up with a quality standard, and we're also working on the taxonomies, which, you know, is all the classification systems. But you can, anybody that wants to communicate with me about this can just send an email to info@ascensionuniversity.org or net, actually. They'll all get to me. So, in fact, you can send it to jerk@.com.
Don't do ascensionuniversity.info, because I tried that and that's somebody else's site.
No, that's somebody else's site. But if you send it to information or info@ascensionuniversity.net, that's the main mailing address for that.
It's .net, not .org?
Yeah, it's actually Ascension University. You'll be able to get to through the .org, .com, or .net.
Hey, this is off the subject, but I've only got Chris on the phone. I just have to ask you. Chris, you know, since you're a young reader, a new reader, I don't know if you're aware that there are, I don't know if you know about them, and there probably are some in your area. I don't know if you're aware, but readers gather together in meeting places called study groups. Are you aware of that?
No, I am aware of it, and I just have been just busy. I've just been running around.
Yeah,
and
so
haven't gone
say,
down.
I think you'd really not just benefit. I don't mean that in a patronizing way. I think you'd really enjoy interacting with other readers. We also have conferences going on during the summer. There's one in Boulder coming up at the end of the month in Colorado, and the other one's in Chicago, which is where I am. But if you're interested in any of that stuff, you know. There are a lot of places you can find out about it.
I want to contact the one. There's one here in Silver Spring that I want to contact. I think it's Lee. The guy's name is Lee, and I want to get into that one. And I'm not going to make it to Colorado this year. I don't know about Chicago yet, but I'm not going to make it out to Colorado this year.
Okay.
Maybe there's other ones going on throughout the summer that I wanted to get to. I think there's something going on in August that I might be able to.
The one in Chicago is at the end of July, and I'm not trying to steer away from this. I'm just letting you know, because I always think that, you know, and I'm not trying to push you, but it's just a huge difference between being an isolated reader on the net and interacting with other readers. It's just a whole different thing, and I want to encourage people whenever possible, if they're up for it, if they have the desire to you know, have some great fellowship time with other readers. So. Anyway,
and also we started a new Facebook group just this last week called Urantia Events group.
Right, I saw that one.
And so we're giving everyone an opportunity to list all kinds of social events, conferences, new books or secondary works, and we would love to include some information about this Ascension University up there, too.
That would be great.
Because I'm sure there are a lot of people that would be very interested in more information. And I also would like to ask you, Bob, to just give us sort of an overview or synopsis of how you came up with this idea, or how you collectively came up with this idea.
Well,
because it sounds just wonderful to me.
You know, I was working in an area called business process outsourcing. I was over in Dubai, which is in the United Arab Emirates, building what was to them the first business process outsourcing park. And one of my jobs was to make things interoperable. In other words, a call center in India would be able to interface with one in Dubai. Excuse me. And we had one in Scotland and several in the United States. And this was all occurring during the time of the do not call list, and most of these communication centers were dialing for dollars, kind of, you know, annoying programs. And we were trying to help them sort of scramble up the value chain and offer services such as customer service, coordination of benefits for an insurance company, other kinds of business processes. But they all had to come off like experts, whatever the subject matter was. And that's what I mean when I refer to expert systems. You're taking an incoming phone call, and the first one is somebody wants the Christina Aguilera concert, you know, on the internet, and they're having problems with Windows Media Player, and you're trying to help them through that call. And the very next call you get might be one with a person that just purchased a glucose meter. They're diabetic and they're having a hard time with the calibration procedure, and they don't trust it. And based on the nature of the call, you would get a screen pop that's basically a script that would let you walk through that. Well, we realized when we're doing that level of granularity, we could essentially re-aggregate courses for colleges. And when I say course, I mean it in both sense, the C-O-U-R-S-E and C-O-A-R-S-E, you know, the second version being fine grain versus coarse grain. And so where there are courses that we're offering, those would be through Ascension University. If we're playing a support role, we would be operating through Experience Bank. Both of those are going to be part of the charitable service that we're hoping to set up, and I'm hoping that Experience Bank will be wildly popular so that we can fund Ascension University with it. My vision is to provide as many courses as we possibly can at no charge. There will be some $10 courses, but if you want a Six Sigma Black Belt, you know, quality certification, you'd probably pay the same $2,500 that you'd pay, you know, anywhere else. And our hope is that would help to, you know, to fund the courses that we're offering at no or just no charge or token money.
I wish, Bob, that my dad had known you. My dad died when he was in 1995, but my dad was basically a materialistic atheist guy, but I think he would have really respected, you know, he was into all this stuff. He was into expert systems. He was into artificial intelligence. He was into all these things. And, you know, if he could have talked to someone like you who has a background in all this engineering and all these, you know, integrative systems, I think he really would have gotten him to come around a little bit. I mean, I think that, you know, he thought the Urantia book was pretty flaky. But I think if you knew that there were people like yourself who, you know, with the kind of scientific or you know, engineering background that you have, getting involved in it, you know, as we're believers in the Urantia book, I think he really would have maybe taken a second look. But let me ask you this, because I think one of the things that I brought up on the show last week about integrating the Urantia book with other sources,
mm-hmm.
To me, it's not enough to study the Urantia book. And this is the thing that I think is so important, because, you know, and this is not as true now as it was 20 years ago, 25 years ago when I started reading the Urantia book. But there are people who are Urantia book fundamentalists. It's, you know, I actually know of one couple who said, well, we read the Urantia book and we haven't read another book since, you know. And there are some people who really feel that way, that all they need is the Urantia book. They don't need anything else. Now, the problem with that is that the Urantia book itself integrates its text with other sources. We have human source authors that the Erasmus uses. The Erasmus quotes the Bible, quotes all kinds of, you know, I think that's completely antithetical to what the Revelators want us to do. The Revelators want us to read all kinds of things from, you know, they take, you know, stuff from philosophy, science, religion, humanity, I mean, everything. So to me, what you're doing is consistent with the vision, you know, with the vision of the Revelators. I guess what I'm asking is did you kind of have that in mind when you had this idea for this university? Was it? I'm assuming it was something that you thought the Revelators would highly approve of.
Well, I mean, you know, we have a trifold brochure that I distributed at the Florida students for the Rancho Book Conference. I wasn't able to make it, but I sent some literature down because they have a literature table every year, and I've gone to it before. And basically, when I started reading the Urantia Papers, I didn't know anybody else that had read the Urantia Papers. I mean, the guy that, you know, I was doing an all-night radio show, and this guy came by the radio station, and he was leading with government on a neighboring planet, you know, thought that it had some mind-blowing potential, you know, and he was using it in a way that I found to be actually offensive, but he left it behind. And maybe a year later, I was having a party, and there was this girl sitting cross-legged on my living room floor that was reading the book. And I said, "What's that?" And she says, "It's a Bible from outer space." And at that point, you know, I kind of, oh, cool. You know? And so I picked it up and started skimming through it. It was only much later that I, you know, got the names of people that were running various study groups and that kind of thing. But so my first fellowship kind of experience with the Urantia Papers was also problematic. I mean, I was the kind of guy that Meredith Sprunger was describing as he was talking about the messianic aspirant. And at one point, you know, I probably alienated just about everybody in my life trying to force this text on them.
Could you just repeat that again one more time? We may actually have to have you call in separately, Bob.
Okay.
Because I'm assuming it's a three-way coming through Andre's line.
That's possible. I don't know if that's what it is or not.
Okay.
There's also a bunch of rap music in the background.
Oh, really?
That is interfering with our listeners being able to hear. So it might be one of the callers, but I've muted most of them, I think.
Okay.
So
sorry, callers.
Why don't we get some of those people on? We should get some.
Our board is really lighting up. So.
Okay, why don't we do that? Do you want to call back? Well, you know what? The only thing I was Bob calling back in is, you know, I don't want to tie up the line.
Let me just wrap that one thought, if I may. Because of that integration. Basically, I was using the Urantia Papers later on after I learned a thing or two, had a couple of disappointing experiences. I basically started using the Urantia Papers to frame Bible studies. And I always did the justifications with biblical chapter and verse. But I would take the general concept from the Urantia Papers. And I serve on a committee called the Global Endeavor with Neil Waldrop and Barb Newsom and Bob DeBold. And Barbara also was doing a lot of the same thing, we realized when we were meeting at one point, that she was using the Urantia Papers in a Bible study context. And I've got a copy of the Dr. Sadler's Bible study workbook sitting on my desk here.
Oh, really? I didn't know you had one. That's fascinating. You're getting into an area that I find particularly interesting because I have a Christian background.
And Andre, if you ever did listen to the recording that he has online, you would be very impressed with the depthness with which Bob has done this. Bob, I just listened to that this morning and was really moved. I thought you did an excellent job.
I don't know which one you listened to, but thanks. There's about seven or eight of them, and they're at avia.com, AEVIA.com, and you can just click on, you can get an overview of Ascension University and the Avia group. Go on.
How do you spell Avia?
A-E-V as in Victor, I-A, and we use it as an acronym to mean appreciation for the enduring value of individual advancement. Avia was used in choral music, just the vowels of Alleluia, and it was used in choral music to mean this passage should be sung praisefully.
952, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Jim Downs.
Hi, Jim.
I'm glad to hear you.
Great.
Bob mentioned that he and I have been working on this, the values proposition and the thing, the values that we put in those various colleges. And the overall comment is that, you know, first of all, that it's a personality to personality, a person to person relationship that makes things work. And I knew Bob from before, and so when he called me and described this to me, I was enthusiastic about working on it. But this whole thing about you've been talking about connecting, you know, just regular life with the Urantia book, and that's all, you know, the Urantia book mentions several times that the entire universe is a university. And that's one thing that really, really excited me about this whole project, that Ascension University will be a tie-in for the Angels of Progress and the Angels of Commerce and whoever else to work with, not only in the foreseeable future, but possibly even into the Ages of Light and Life. You know, this is a long-term project.
And that's the root word of university.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just had one question I wanted to get in, and then you can clear up my line. I wanted to see how your approach is. I understand the general concept of uplifting people, but how do you apply, you know, the Urantia book to, let's say, math? How do you go about doing that?
Well, the Urantia book, for example, refers to, you know, in the wave energy manifestations section. The Urantia papers refer to spectrum as 100 octaves of wave energy. The Urantia papers have things to say in the realm of mathematics, and it's another way of looking at things. You know, visible light, roughly, you know, 350 to about 700 nanometers. The Urantia papers say that the visible light of the sun constitutes one octave. Well, guess what? That's about one octave. You know, that's the only example I can think of just off the roof of my mouth, but you know, I'm sure there are numerous others. I'm sorry?
Now, how much of that also...
And before Chris hangs up, though, we have a question from the board for Chris. Someone wanted to ask if it was a Muslim reader of the book who gave you the book, or if he just, I mean, what was the connection between him and the book?
Well, he got the book from a friend of his who read half of it. I'm not sure how he got the book, but he is Muslim. He's a pretty avid Muslim. So talking to him after, you know, he read the book, he gave me the book, and then, you know, he kind of has kind of distanced himself from it. I mean, whenever I talk to him about it, he still references a lot from the Quran, and you know, he has expressed certain issues with it, with the Urantia book. So, I mean, he is Muslim, and he does, you know, without knowing it a lot of the time, agree with it. He just doesn't. I don't know if it's gotten through to his, I don't know if it's accessed the process. I think he's still stuck in tradition of what he's grown up in, which is the Quran and things like that. So he is Muslim. He's a reader as far as he's read it, but it hasn't changed him as far as, you know, kind of taking another look at the Quran. He still holds the Quran.
That's fascinating.
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to thank Chris for answering that question for one of our guests on the board.
Hey, Chris, write to me. It's Bob.
I will.
All right. I'm in Silver Spring, by the way, so we can meet for lunch or something.
All right. Sure.
Sounds good.
And the thing is, okay, so we're back. Okay, you were talking about. I would love to do a whole show, by the way, with you, Bob, just on the Bible study issue, because I think that's an issue that I find really interesting. Something I'd love to talk to you about further. But
yeah, me too. In fact, I would love to just make a suggestion that that would be a great workshop to have at conferences on a regular basis.
I agree, and I've been encouraging Bob to come to the conferences again. And I know that you're on a tight budget right now, but I think it would just be great to have you at conferences. I mean, I think you'd be a great workshop leader and a great resource.
Well,
so.
It was one of the best courses that I ever took at the Boulder School. It has served me so well in doing outreach with Christians.
You were at the Boulder School, Crystal. Who taught that course?
Don Diamond taught that course.
Oh, okay.
And he was a Urantia book reader who had gone through seminary pretty much just to learn what he needed to know to talk the Urantia book with Christians.
Wow.
Which, you know, was a pretty solid commitment, I thought, on his part.
Yeah.
Well, that was Meredith's ministry was certainly along those lines. So.
Yeah. Well, we also had an anonymous professor who I can't name who has a degree in Pauline theology who was a Urantia book reader teaches at a major university right now, and he was on our show talking. He's written books about atonement, and he was on the show talking about atonement, which I thought was really interesting. He's definitely knowledgeable about the Bible. But anyway, because you were telling us that you started doing that, how you got the idea for this Urantia University. You were saying that when you started doing Bible studies. This is back in the 70s when you started doing that.
Yes, I was introduced to the Urantia Papers. Well, I mean, I picked up the Urantia Papers and read them seriously for the first time in 1972. And I was probably more of an atheist or agnostic at that point, and I just wanted God to be part of my life. I had a bit of a Deuteronomy moment. And let me describe that quickly. I mean, my idea of a big-time Saturday night prior to inviting God to just basically take my life and refashion it in accordance with his will, my idea of a big-time Saturday night was to sit around a water pipe with a bunch of friends and smoke until we fell over. And then when we woke up, we'd take the Chianti out of the water pipe and boil it on the stove and stand in the steam till we fell over. And I had one of these experiences. I don't know to this day if it was an out-of-body experience or whether it was just a drug-induced hallucination, but I found myself hovering over the room, looking at all my friends laying around on the carpet, and The Who was on the radio, and they were, it was at the point of the song Teenage Wasteland where the music abruptly stops and the singer screams, "They're all wasted." And I remember thinking, I don't want to be wasted. And I think that was my, Deuteronomy moment, and I'm referring specifically to the line that says, "I set before you life and death, therefore choose life." And, my steps were ordered from that point on to this day. And, a lot of the experiences I thought were total dead-end, waste-of-time kind of experiences, they actually are relevant to what I'm doing now, right now today. So.
Wow. So you started doing, can you tell me your answer? So you said you started doing Bible studies with the Urantia book. How long were you reading the Urantia book when you started doing that?
Oh, probably 2 years. So I'd say
okay.
74, 75 time frame.
Okay. I'm still hearing a weird background noise too. Not as bad as it was before, but I'm hearing something.
Well,
anyway.
Oh, I think we're just going to have to live with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, so were you doing Bible studies with other readers?
No, I didn't know other readers.
Oh, so you were doing it by yourself. Okay.
Right. I probably didn't connect with the community of readers until 1980 or so.
Okay.
And then when the schism occurred, I just dropped out. I didn't want any part of it. So I just went back to reading the book.
Right. Wow, that's interesting. So again, how did you, so again, we've been sort of going all over the place here, but we're still trying to figure out how you actually got the idea for Ascension University. You said you were working with expert systems and things like that.
Yeah, you know, what happens is, I mean, you've got a client that wants you to teach a certain thing, you know, for training or for customer support services or whatever. So you end up developing systems that just play well in the education arena. And so to take subject matter from the National Science Foundation's taxonomies of the sciences and to put Bloom's taxonomies in there and fold in a little bit of the North American Free Trade Agreement's industry classification codes and the Dewey Decimal System and the Chinese Library System, I came up with a thing called the Index of Human Endeavor, which is part of the Experience Bank Index that I use. So as I indicated, where the delivery is granular, in other words, we're just sending one little fact nugget to a screen pop, that would be delivered by Experience Bank, where it becomes more of an aggregation. It would be more course-like. And so at that point, I realized that this could be used to essentially teach advanced truth, and that the best way to do that would be to blend it with what we already have. So it's a revelation augmenting evolution.
Wow.
Right.
And it's also
really the Jesusonian method.
Right. And also I would argue that evolution needs to augment revelation as well. Evolution works together with revelation.
I agree with you. Yeah.
And the Rapture book actually makes that clear. It says that it talks about how Christianity had to, it talks about Paul, and it says that Paul, you know, had to compromise basically, and said that eventually revelation had to get under the graduated control of evolution. I can't remember exactly how they phrase it, but there's that whole dynamic dance between the two. So how would you? I mean, let's say someone graduates from Ascension University, what kind of an education do you foresee them getting? What is your vision of the well-rounded Ascension student.
25 years from today, maybe, an Ivy League education. It's just, you know,
wow.
Again, augmented with the material or the content of the Urantia papers. Now, you know, there's going to be a whole lot of baby steps. But even for the people that we serve, there are a whole lot of baby steps. I mean, I'm just as concerned about the guy that jumps on a shovel for a living who has this great dream to someday be the team leader of people that jump on shovels for a living.
Right.
I mean, I think to the extent that you teach them, interpersonal communications skills and the kind of thing that's going to help impress his management, you know, as he ascends the corporate ladder, I think that's important too. I mean, Jim and I went back and forth about the question of whether the part of the AVIA acronym should end in advancement or whether it should be achievement or accomplishment. And I'm just thinking, you know, if we move him 6 inches down Eternity Road, that's pretty good, you know.
Yeah. So how do you see the Urantia book being integrated into the curriculum? I mean, for example, you were talking about how, in comparative religion, let's say you're taking a class, let's say people are taking that just means that the Urantia papers would be well represented in the as one of the things, one of the many religious texts they would study. But would you want all the teachers, for example, at the university to be familiar to some extent with the Urantia book? Is that basically your goal?
Well, I think the teachers would have to understand that the Urantia book is guiding a lot of the decisions that are being made in the curriculum focus groups.
Okay.
And that there's going to be a number of committed Urantia book readers in the curriculum focus groups. But that's not the primary criteria. I think the primary, because even in biblical fundamentalism, I mean, you end up with, David Koresh and Jim Jones. I mean, these guys were fundamentalists. The thing I think that they were missing was the spirit that indwelt them and enveloped them not being heeded, And so it's really about being more responsive to divine leading. And to the extent that you've got somebody that's committed to that process, to allow the spirit of truth to lead them into all truth, no matter where, no matter how many sacred cows get tipped, in the process, that's the kind of individual that you want on, a curriculum group. So, and I don't see us
that's a really good point, I think, because, God knows we need some educational redress. I mean, it really has become a pretty dysfunctional system. and it isn't meeting the needs that education had originally set out to meet.
No argument from me.
I came from a school system overseas to the school system here, and while I thought it was quite recreational, it didn't seem to apply in any way to life skill development, or certainly didn't have much effect on success driven models.
And sometimes it just doesn't reach people in a way that's meaningful to them. My dad passed away, and my mother, who was paralyzed from the chest down, was unable to keep her house, and my sisters and I had to go and kind of clean the place out and get it ready for sale. And one of my sisters sent me a box of letters, and I read them all, and they were letters from my teachers to my parents, and this was elementary school level. And every one of those letters said, "I just can't motivate him." I mean, I was not a successful student. And that's one of the reasons why I have such a passion for education today. So I find myself many years later sitting in a parent-teacher conference with my son, who is a musician and basically lives and breathes music and doesn't have a whole lot of time for anything other than music. And I'm listening to his history teacher saying, "I just can't motivate him." You know, and I'm going, "Well, gosh, you guys haven't learned much in the last, 30 years, have you?" But, I mean, I said that to myself. I didn't say that to him. The question I asked him was, "Well, my son loves music, right?" And he goes, "Right." And I said, "Well, did you consider maybe assigning an essay to him, like on what, Elvis's influence might have been on the civil rights movement?" Because my son would have just picked up with that and run with it, with tremendous enthusiasm, I might add,
I love what you're saying. I really do, because I think and we're really going to go off the subject here, but you've gotten me on a subject that I'm really passionate about, Bob. Because first of all, I know that your answer book talks about the importance of being well-rounded and the importance of being a Renaissance person. But I think it's sort of I hate to say this, but with all due respect to the book, I think it almost overstates the case a little bit about that, because I think that. As much as I'm into integration and all that, I think here's why I say that. I think that we'd be much happier as a society if we had a little bit more of a specialized education system. Now, when I say specialized, the interesting thing about that, though, is I think that the dichotomy between specialized and being well-rounded is actually a false one. Because I think if you pursue what interests you, you actually will become well-rounded by default.
Absolutely.
Because you will, and I'll give you an example. I got very interested, and I don't want to say what it is on the air, but I got very interested in the social issue when I was in college, okay, which I won't mention here because it's just going to create too much controversy. But I got very interested in a particular social issue, okay, and I was not interested in politics at all before that. Everybody kept saying, "You've got to vote, you've got a civic duty to do this," and I didn't care, okay, until I got interested in the social issue. And then when I got interested in the social issue, I started getting interested in what was going on in the state capitol. I started getting interested in the Constitution. I started getting interested in Supreme Court decisions. I mean, all these things, I was able to, because of my interest in this one issue, I got interested by default in other things that were related to it. But then I saw how they bridged from this one issue to these other things. And it just became, it was a completely stress-free way of learning. Because nobody ever said, "Okay, we're going to force you to study this or this or this." It just I saw how one thing built on another. And I want to share an anecdote that has been shared in a lot of homeschooling circles. And I don't know how familiar you are with homeschooling, but I really I'm a big fan of it if the parents are really motivated. There was a homeschooling conference that was done by a couple named Ray and Dorothy Moore back in the late 70s and early 80s, and they would tell the parents, they'd say, "Build on the child's interests." And their mother, one of the mothers came up and said, "Well, my kid isn't interested in anything. What am I going to do?" And they said, "He's got to be interested in something." And she said, "Motorcycles. That's all he cares about." And they said, "Good. Well, go buy him every single motorcycle magazine you can." And they said, "Okay," and see what happens. So 2 weeks later, the kid was working at a bicycle shop. He was repairing lawnmowers. He was doing, and guess what? He had to become well-rounded. He had to learn math. He had to learn economics. But it was something he did naturally because it was consistent with his passion. So I mean, if we could take education from even from the earliest years and do that, I just think we'd have a revolution.
Well, I believe we can, and I think...
Well, and the Urantia book pretty much alludes to the fact that we need to specialize first before we generalize.
What makes
Doesn't
you say
it?
That?
I mean, that's the way I've read it. What do you think, Bob?
I'm not sure I have an opinion on that, but what I was mightily impressed with the Urantia papers was the line about the home being the most basic education institution and the basic religious institution. And so part of the criteria for developing Ascension U was to essentially make it scalable so that you could support a home church that had a couple people sitting across the kitchen table, or a home school where there were a couple of people sitting across the kitchen table. And since it's based on open source software, we don't have to play Mother May I to scale it up to support 100,000 people. All we have to do is pay for the bandwidth and the hosting. So
I haven't thought about the implications of that, but that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, I didn't mean to avoid your question. I just hadn't thought about it before.
Well, the part in the book where it refers to that is that our educational system is really totally hypothetical, and that they recommend, that what we really need to do is to develop functional citizenry, is that everybody should have a skill, a marketable skill, and should be able to sort of pursue their passion.
So I think
if they're interested in academia, then that is something that can be done after they've sort of qualified as a self-sufficient.
Well, that's on the government even planning.
Yeah, that was, But I think Cosmic Citizen is doing Cosmic Citizen is doing a tremendous service when it comes to bringing people up on the obligations and the responsibilities of citizenship. I mean, the discussion that you're having every week is greatly instructive in that area. I've downloaded several of the MP3 files and listened to them in the car when I'm going from place to place. But there was one other thing that you touched on as far as, being able to deliver to people that really need it. If you look at the touting of the Saudi Arabian government about Saudi University, it's a wonderful university and it admits women, except it doesn't admit women into any of the engineering courses. And if you look at what young girls have to go through in Afghanistan, with having acid thrown on their faces just because they want to get a general education. When I say that we're going to make Ascension University multimodal, I'm referring to that. We can send an MP3 player loaded with lectures anywhere in the world for about $7, including the cost of the MP3 player. So, there were issues in our own country's history where slaves basically had to hide their Bibles. We know that the Protestant Reformation was born in part because, the priesthood, wanted to play the scriptures close to the vest, and they didn't think the general public was going to be, capable of understanding them. Well, maybe that's true. I mean, I don't know. Talk to the average student. But in any event, for us to be able to deliver this content anywhere in the world to people that can kind of, secretly work on self-improvement.
Well,
I think that's
the value. I think that's the value of technology, okay? Or that's one of the values of technology, but the fact that, it can make everything so accessible to people. That's why I think it's harder for a dictatorship to really flourish today than it was in the past, because there's too much. And I know the Chinese are trying to censor the internet and all of that. I don't know how successful they've been at doing a lot of things.
Well, yesterday and the day before, they were using umbrellas to block the views of cameras at Tiananmen Square. I thought that was actually pretty funny, but I guess it's not really that funny when you think about it. But.
Well, the thing is, here's my concern, though, about technology. As much as I love technology, as someone who's totally blind, technology has been an incredible service to me because I don't have I don't have to depend on anybody to read to me anymore. Okay, I've got a scanner, I've got a computer with a braille display. Everything I want can be in braille now, which is fantastic. But here's the downside of it. Some people may think this is just sort of petty, but I really don't think it is. What about the value of face-to-face, body-to-body communication? There's something to be said for that kind of interaction. I mean, I guess my concern is about the potential for isolation, for somebody sitting around their computer that even if they're interacting with people, it's just not the same as being in a face-to-face setting, you know, with people. Where does that fit into to the model?
Well,
that you're
the design criteria for Ascension University basically is to develop systems that support both the sage on the stage and the guide on the side. And so, if you decide to rent a little, we want to support the sage on the stage as well as the guide on the side. In other words, the teacher that's doing a lecture in addition to the person that's a moderator or a facilitator. And people have different teaching styles, and we basically want to support, you know, those that would, you know, facilitate this instruction. And so we're essentially making, the plan is to make the content available. Now, if you want to rent a meeting room at the public library and use the material that's on Ascension University to conduct a class without having to, you know, put that class together from scratch, we'd like to be in a role that supports that effort.
Well, see, what I think would be fantastic, and this is only possible once the concept becomes really, really worldwide, but I think it'd be great if you had field representatives in every area, you know, where people could, you know, where you not only had the sage on the stage, you know, giving a lecture, but you actually had multiple people in every region. You know, who, of course, that's not going to happen now because we don't have, you know, our readership is so, you know, Rancho readership is so small right now that I could see in a couple of hundred years something like that. Where you have,
but why would it have to be limited to your Rancho readers?
Why would it have to be what?
Why would you have to limit this?
You have to at least people that would be, at least be willing to support the concept. Okay, I mean, the question, I mean, how many people right now, how many people from outside the Urantia movement do you think would if they knew the Urantia book was being used? I think you'd get somewhat of a percentage of people. But I mean, the point I'm making is we don't have the numbers right now, though, to have a field representative. You would need more than one field representative in every area, because you would need field representatives who specialize in various disciplines, to, you know, the, kind of like teaching assistants in a sense. But I could see that eventually down the road as something that would, you know, that could happen.
And I can see those teaching assistants.
I mean, that's sort of the same. Yeah. I mean, I guess I disagree with you on that, because I see that there's a huge need for that, even outside of the realm of people who are existing Urantia Book students, in that I run a TED study group in another city, and one of the people who attended my TED study group was trying to determine whether or not he really wanted to invest in going to university, or whether he would rather just join one of our other subgroups, which was a MBA study without a degree, basically taking all of the course materials that was currently being used to get an MBA, and having small in-home study groups that read the same material, discussed it, and learned, and sort of went forward without having to pay what at that point was an, you know, really high tuition to get that kind of education. And I think that wasn't
Crystal, I'm having a hard time hearing you. You're breaking up on us. I don't know if other people are saying that, but I'm not catching everything you're saying. You've got like
I'm breaking up also.
Yeah. Are you using Skype?
No. Okay, I'm on my regular phone.
Okay, well, I don't know what the problem is. But anyway.
Can I add something?
Jim,
sure.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've been here listening. One of the things that you mentioned there, Andre, was that a couple of hundred years in the future, and what's so wonderful about this university is that it's either going to be overt or covert Urantia Book infusion,
right.
But, you know, it's going to be infused. In a couple of hundred years from now, if you're teaching math like Chris was talking about, you know, the concepts in the Urantia Book will already be infused in the study, and so it'll come through, even if you're not aware of it. It's already in. I mean, we got lots of people out there that don't know that they're being influenced by the Urantia book, and they are.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that there's a...
Are we still on the air?
I think we are. So. No, we're just all, you know, pausing and considering what wise old Jim
he's
just told.
He's been up in thought.
But, now I lost my train of thought.
Another thought I had was that you were asking what kind of teachers, whether they would be your answer book teachers or not, but it depends on the subject matter.
Yeah, I would agree. I agree.
I plan on having two classes there because I've written two books that have to do with it, maybe three. One is just positive qualities. What do they mean to you? And it you could be a Muslim or a atheist or anything. So, you know, my motivation and my inspiration came from the Urantia book, but I'm not going to say you have to read the Urantia book to understand positive qualities. And the other one is that I wrote a book called The Nature and Attributes of God. So again, asking the students, well, who's God? You know, if God is all this important, who is he to you? And again, you don't have to be a Urantia book reader to attend that class.
Yes, very true.
Well, we just had a question on the board from one of our obviously new guests on the show, and he or she wants to know, what is the Urantia book? Anybody want to tackle that for our guest?
I would yield to Jim.
Okay, let's think. The Urantia book is a book that tells us about God and the universe, bigger than we thought of. It tells us about Jesus and who he was. It tells us about the history of this planet. And it tells us what we're going to encounter when we leave this planet. And a whole bunch of other stuff. I know that's a nutshell, but that's basic. I mean, you know, obviously, it could go on and on.
And it's highly influential in the lives of the folks that happen to be calling in right now. So.
Well, and I think we should be more specific here. I think you know, first of all, there's a great article on Wikipedia about the subject. And by the way, Bob, were you by any chance involved in the Attitude Matter article? Because I've been trying to figure out who's been involved with that. I thought it was a very good article. And I use the Wikipedia article to introduce people to the book. But the Urantia book is...
David Cantor spends quite a bit of time.
Okay, because I want to, I'm actually going to try to get David Cantor on the show next week, and that's something I should just tell the listeners right now. David Cantor is involved in something called the Christian Urantia Society, which will be a virtual society designed to integrate Christianity in the Urantia book, and I think it's a great idea, something I think is long overdue, and I am really, really excited about having him on the show. I think he's going to be on next week. So, and by the way, unfortunately, he's using Skype too, so we'll have to deal with the Skype issue. But one thing I was going to say was that the Urantia book, and I couldn't quite hear you, Jim, what your response was to our listener, but let me try to tackle that too. The Urantia book is a book that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities, and it claims to be a revelation. And one of its purposes is to give us a lot of new information that we're missing and to correct errors and mistakes that have been in various religions throughout history. And the word Urantia means earth. It's spelled Urantia, and it's a name that the revelators, which is what the authors call themselves, the revealers of truth, give to our planet. And so that's the book has all kinds of different content. I mean, the book starts out with five papers on the nature of God. The book talks about the history of our planet. It also talks about the life and teachings of Jesus. In fact, the last part of the book, which is a favorite part of the book for many people, part four is called The Life and Teachings of Jesus, and it's 800 pages. Now, the book, I should tell you, is 2,097 pages long, so it's quite a dense book, The Life and Teachings of Jesus is 800 pages or so. And that's the last part of the book. And it claims to include information that is not in the Bible. For example, information about Jesus' childhood, what he did between the ages of 12 and 30 before his public ministry, and also additional information about his public ministry, which is not in the Bible. So there's a lot of stuff that the book claims to give us. The book also talks about life after death. It talks about how we are part of a huge universe of inhabited, universe of inhabited planets. The book talks about it gives a huge sort of what you call a cosmology. It talks about how our planet is part of a system, and our system is part of a constellation, and our constellation is part of what's called a local universe, and our local universe is part of a super universe. And there are seven super universes, and at the center of all the seven super universes is a creation called Havona, which is a creation of a billion perfect worlds. And at the center of Havona is paradise. So the book kind of gives us a whole detailed cosmology of, you know, what about our role in the universe, you know, other inhabited planets. And basically it talks about how, you know, this is our first life. And the universe is kind of like a big school. Or actually, the way I like to talk about it is the universe, growth is the natural order of things. So just as a fetus becomes a baby, and a baby becomes a child, and a baby becomes a toddler, and a toddler becomes a child, and a child becomes an adolescent, and an adolescent becomes a young adult, in the same way, we will, when we die, we will go to the next stage of our existence. And the next stage, and the next stage. So it's not reincarnation, but it's resurrection into a higher state of being. The book calls that the ascension scheme. So when we start here, we kind of ascend through the universe and through these various worlds and spheres, and eventually we get to paradise. And then once we get to paradise, we enter what's called the core of the finality. We become what the book calls finaliters. And what that basically is an eternal service project, basically, when we will go on to other planets like this one and serve and reign in the universe. So the book gives us a whole glorious destiny for humankind. I've just given you a real thumbnail sketch of kind of what we are into here on The Cosmic Citizen and what we believe in. And if you have any other questions, please ask, or please feel free to call in. We'd have to untie one of the lines, though. One of the callers will have to.
We have an open line.
Oh, we do. Okay. Okay, please feel free to call in if you want to ask any more questions. Our number here is 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. So if any of this interests you, you know, please call in.
Let me add something to that.
Jim?
Okay.
Sure.
Say that again, Jim.
I said let me add something to that.
Sure.
The word Urantia, the first part of it, U-R-A-M, means heaven. Or heavenly, and the TIA means place. So literally, etymologically, it means your heavenly place.
Well, thanks for that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, in fact, Chris Alverson has talked about that on the air before. We should do a whole show with Chris just on the etymology, because the book has a lot of names and terms that it coins, and we could just have a field day with just the etymology itself. So, and by the way, Bob, I wanted to just piggyback on something you said earlier. You said that what we're doing here at The Cosmic Citizen is so important every week. Well, I thank you for that. I want to also say to you that it kind of dovetails what we're talking about with special with our interests and the things I love. I've been a radio nerd since I was a kid. I mean, listeners don't know this, but when I was a kid, I used to call up DJs at radio stations and ask them about, you know, about their work and ask them about the industry. I knew more about radio than any kid should be allowed to know. And it's just sad because I really wish that, you know, we had set up a system in our education where I could have apprenticed at a radio station when I was 13 or 14, you know, in addition to the classes I was taking. You know, I think that would have been a great idea, and unfortunately we don't have that kind of system set up.
Well, you'd have to bump Larry in order to let somebody apprentice.
Well, we could have someone in addition to Larry.
Oh, okay.
Larry's our techie, but we could have...
I was kidding, Larry. So.
Yeah, I know.
I've seen myself as sort of an apprentice here. I have no idea what I'm doing. I've just learned from being on the air. So this is my apprenticeship here on this show.
Well, I think it's a great service. I'm really enjoying
you.
It.
Thank you.
And yeah, I think that anybody that wants it, I'm sorry about the audio quality. anybody that really wants to hear it clearly as far as the an overview of the focus groups, though, could go to avia.com and just click on the audio links there. And at least, there are 12 focus groups, and there's kind of a keynote address for 7 of the 12. The other ones are still being written. So.
And it, what from what I heard, it's really just very eloquent, and I'm very impressed with it, the overall clarity of the concept.
Well, there's one other thing that I might suggest, and that is if somebody goes to the ascensionuniversity.org site, in the upper left-hand corner is an address called On Time, and that is probably a good example of how Urantia concepts would be integrated with a time management course, with what would traditionally be called a time management course. Because basically what I did was I took a time management course that I had gone through at one point, and I included what I had learned from the Urantia book concerning time and the definition of time.
Well, that's funny you should mention that, because that actually also connects with what David Nash is doing with body clocks and biorhythms and that kind of thing.
Well, that's cool. I'd love to learn more from him about that, because I work till 3 o'clock in the morning in a kind of a burn and churn job, and I don't have quite as much energy for these projects during the day, so I'm probably gonna have to make some changes in that area. But David might have some good advice too. So. But anyway, the on-time audio is, you know, pretty good example of what other courses might look like or sound like.
Have you talked to Gar Jameson at all about this project? Because we had him on the air, and he's a professor himself.
I never have, no.
Okay, I think he'd be very interested in it. And he's somebody else you might want to connect with at some point.
Well, I will make an effort to contact Gar. So.
How much time do we have left, Crystal? Crystalline, I should say.
We've got about 32 minutes left.
Okay. Well, again, if anybody wants to call in, please do, 716-646-8158, 716-646-8158. We're talking about Ascension University, which would be kind of based on a liberal arts college curriculum, but it would be one where the Urantia book and its worldview would kind of be interwoven throughout the curriculum. That doesn't mean every teacher has to be a reader of the Urantia book. And you do have a good point, by the way. You're both Crystalline and Jim, both of you guys have a good point that if we were to, even if we had things like multiple field representatives, that they wouldn't all have to be Urantia book readers doing the teaching and the assisting, as long as they weren't opposed or antagonistic to the concept at all. You're asking because you want to take truth from everywhere you can. So you want to take wisdom from. So you can't just restrict. There's no point in restricting only this whole thing just to Urantia book readers.
Well, I mean, I have a couple of teachers lined
up.
And one of them.
We have two others.
Okay.
Sorry. Go on.
No, I'm done. I just have a couple of teachers lined up. One of them has a PhD in English, and she teaches speech specifically for people that have limited English proficiency, people for whom English is a second or a third language. And so she's developing a course in that area that will likely play on Ascension U, and there are several others. I'm not going to snooker anybody and bring a person in that's a fundamentalist Christian that would have major objections to the Urantia papers without revealing to them that there are people in the curriculum groups that are, that do have a Urantia worldview. There will also be others on the curriculum groups that might not have a Urantia worldview. So,
right.
I think
both Chris and Albert, it looks like, want to ask a question. So Chris had his hand up first, so we'll go to him. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a comment and a question, and I got to think of what the question was, because as soon as you told me I had my hand up, I blanked out. But my comment was that the method the way that you integrated in the way you said that that people are being influenced without even knowing. I mean, I think that's really interesting, because it's that happens all the time. Whenever you tell somebody about the concepts in the book, they believe it, but then they tell them about the book and they don't believe it. So I think that that's interesting. My other question was about in the Urantia book, there's a lot of talk. There's one section, because what I was doing, trying to build this University of Urantia, I was kind of trying to structure it off of just one quote that's in there. And that one quote was is about the two different schools at the time of the magisterial sun, which is the schools of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and then the school of the planetary prince. And there's a lot of agriculture involved. How do you plan on putting agriculture in the Ascension University?
I'm glad that you asked that. And basically, Ascension University, and I know that this term is overused a lot, there was a paradigm shift that took place in my planning and in the architecture of a charitable service that I've been working on for about 25 years. My passion was essentially to address issues of food security, housing security, and employment security. And when I went off to work in the Arab Emirates, I had a number of websites that dealt with some of the practical issues related to each of those subjects. When I came back, my impression when I looked at those websites after, you know, half a dozen months was, this looks like it's a tribute to ADHD. It just wasn't coherent at all. And I was rather embarrassed by, you know, that effort. And I realized in trying to, you know, rally people to work on some of these problems and bring some of the technologies into the public domain that are, you know, related to food security, for example, that there was going to have to be an educational component of that. And I already had the passion for sharing the Urantia papers and the advanced truths that are contained in the Urantia papers. So I was able to combine a whole lot of those efforts. Yes.
Bob, can you repeat that? We lost you on almost the entire last paragraph.
So. Okay. Basically, part of the charitable service that I've been designing for 25 years focuses on food security, housing security, and employment security. And so a part of the motivation for doing Ascension University was to address those issues and to get people focused on those areas in ways that aren't going to increase the cost for the consumer of food, for example. So hydroponics was a great big part of this initial effort. And, you know, water rights are kind of like intellectual rights in a way. If you're living upstream from Los Angeles and you think that you're going to divert a river to irrigate your crops and have the people of Los Angeles, you know, drinking the runoff from that effort, think again. It's not going to happen. And when I was in Dubai, I spent a considerable amount of time studying the World Food Program in the context of that area, and also researching a thing called the Falaj, which is an underground irrigation system that's been used for a couple of thousand years. The thing that kind of struck me as incongruous was that they have to desalinate the water, and then they spray it out into the air, and about half of it evaporates before it ever makes it to the ground. And so this idea of closed-circuit irrigation systems is going to be a big one in the United States and throughout the world, because of how precious water actually is. And I'm hoping that we will spend a whole lot of the resources initially in addressing those food security and housing security and employment security kind of issues.
Well, that is very fascinating. I'm very interested in hearing more about that, Bob.
Okay.
But let's ask Albert what he has to say here. Hold on a minute.
Yes. Hello?
Hey, Albert.
Hi, Al.
Hey, how you doing? Am I on the line?
Yes, you're on here.
Yes, great, thank you. My comments go back to things that were being said about 20 minutes ago. I'm sorry for that, but I was, you know, trying to alert you. I hung up.
I didn't have an opportunity to cut in, so.
Okay. You all have been talking about the integration of the Urantia book into curricula and how that may develop over time and, you know, how it may be happening somewhat already in undercurrent type ways. My feeling about this is that we're really going to see educational institutions and universities start to take a much more serious look at the Urantia book much more quickly than most people in the Urantia community think is possible.
Wow. Okay.
And the reason simply being because of the collaborations that are developing and the importance of these collaborations to people in the various fields of study, and probably the most the biggest one coming up is anthropology and archaeology. So right now, 6 of the 15 reports on UB The News have to do with anthropology and archaeology, and I have about that many more that need written up. And, you know, it bears mentioning that anthropologists and archaeologists are a much, much easier crowd of people to deal with at universities than most of the people in the other departments, just because of the nature of the study that they're doing. You know, it has technical aspects to it, of course, but everyone knows it's very speculative, and we're trying to, you know, figure out things from little bits of evidence. And so the point being here is that I don't think the Urantia community has really addressed itself to that statement that the historic facts will stand on the records of the ages to come. And, you know, do we believe that or not? Is that literal or no? The cooperation seemed to suggest that we really ought to give this some serious consideration. And then the reasons for revelation, the first one mentioned, is the authoritative elimination of error, which I think has both community implications as well as personal ones. That is, it's not just that subjectively the Urantia book speaks to us, and so it will become an authoritative elimination of error, but also because it is revelatory and provides historic facts that will stand on the records of the ages to come, its unique and emerging quality of credibility will become increasingly noteworthy. And naturally, because I'm involved with this on a daily basis,
sure,
I have a different opinion than most people are going to have about this. And I, you know, want to say that I certainly respect that. You know, experience as a master teacher and people hearing me talk about this, it's not going to give them the type of impact that, you know, I've had actually going to universities and talking to professors.
No, but let me tell you something, Howard. I think what you're doing is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, I think UB The News is a really tremendous service, and I want to get you on the air again to talk about these corroborations, because we had you on the air talking specifically about Part 3 at one point, but I want to talk specifically about the corroborations, because one of the things that I want to ask you a question, and this is, again, we've really been rambling all over the place today, but, you know, it's probably appropriate given the vision of Ascension University because we're doing a very comprehensive show talking about all kinds of different subjects, which is exactly what Ascension University does. So let me ask you this, and this is something I want to ask you again when we get you back on the air sometime in the future, Albert, but I'm going to ask you this now. Let me just challenge you for a minute, because I believe you. I believe what you're saying, that the academic community is going to embrace the Urantia book more quickly than we think because of the corroborative evidence coming out. Okay. Having said that, though, what about just the objections that you know, given Matthew Block's skepticism, for example, and given the fact that, and this is a fact, that parts of the Urantia book are plagiarized. You know, that's just a fact. I mean, I hate to say that, but that's a fact. But what do we, you know, aren't those things going to, you don't think those things are going to just undermine the credibility of the book in the eyes of most scholars?
No, I don't think so at all, really. At all is an overstatement. Okay, obviously it's an issue for some people, and I appreciate that Matthew Block is a person in the Urantia community who's making a big issue out of this, and, you know, attack. Let's start with the plagiarism thing for starters. Okay, well, first of all, you know, there's plagiarism at two different levels here, definitionally. I mean, one level would be quoting someone directly and not giving credit, and then another type of plagiarism is to take ideas and not give credit. Now, when the Urantia book quotes the Bible or other sources, it does put that in quotes, and my general understanding is you know, those types of quoting, you know, who are you plagiarizing, right? God, if you think the Bible's written by God or whatever. I mean, it's not really an issue, I don't believe, the same way as plagiarizing human source type authorship or things that are not considered sacred text. And then you've got the issue of the ideas. And so, you know, just because Matthew finds some texts that have parallels, first of all, it is jumping to conclusions to presume that what he found is the only thing out there that has those types of parallels to the Urantia book. So, you know, this is the first mistake that people make intellectually, and it happens all the time, that we find one thing and we over-associate with it, and we draw out conclusions that are not in the facts themselves, and we don't take responsibility for how we are interpreting these things.
But, Halvard, okay, let me just say, though, and I know we're on a different subject here, but let me just say, in Matthew's defense, I don't agree with Matthew's conclusion that the book is not a revelation, which is basically what he's now concluded. I mean, he may change his mind. Okay, I agree that the book is a revelation, but one of the things that Matthew's work has done has made me realize, you know what? I used to think that they were just taking ideas, but they're doing more than that. They actually are taking, and they're not even using quotation marks, they actually are taking, and they say they do this, okay? They say they do this, especially in the acknowledgments of Part 4. They say that, you know, that they've resorted to human sources whenever possible. And so they, and you know, they literally, they're not just taking ideas. They are literally taking, a source. For example, I mean, a good example is the Rodin paper. And they give us clues when they do this. They say in modern phraseology and in substance, Jesus said. And so when they do that, we know that they're directly quoting from a human source. And they also do something that a lot of people would be very upset about. They not only quote from a human source without giving attribution, but then they tamper with the words and they alter the wording to fit what they want. Which again, I think it's brilliant. I think it's great that they're.
Well, and in some cases, frankly, they completely reverse the point that the original author was trying to make.
I don't think we should minimize what is going on here and saying, well, this is just one example of other of parallels that are out there in multiple places. I mean, this is really, and that way, even when they quote the Bible, they also sometimes alter the text in ways that I think are brilliant, by the way. But you know, again, I'm just saying this is something that we're going to have to. I'll just say this. I think it's great that we in the Urantia community are acknowledging this and admitting it, and we're not in denial about it. I think that's the first great thing. So I think that's going to give us more credibility among scholars. So,
Andre, I think this is, the larger issue, which I wanted to build up to, but I was afraid if I just dealt with these overarching issues first, we would never get back to some of those specifics. Now, regarding this sort of, you know, just broader attitude about plagiarism, we have to keep in mind the context for that criticism. That criticism only comes, in a substantial way. In a way, when I say substantial, I mean where people care about it and they take offense or are critical of the book because of its plagiarism. You know, pretty much universally, that only comes from people who do not believe in the authenticity of the Urantia book. That's where that criticism comes from. Because Urantia book readers typically, almost universally in my experience, will just simply say, well, the book says it uses different human authorship, and, you know, we all know that. And, of course, they're not going to, you know, try to footnote every human author.
Sure, but we need to
have an impact.
We need to concede, though, that these critics are correct in their factual in the statement that the book is, and the book is, I mean, the book, parts of the book are plagiarized. That is a fact. That does not mean that does not take away from the authenticity of the book. That does not take away from the revelatory character of it. But, you know, from a technical, I mean, I guess that point is plagiarism has such a negative connotation in people's minds. That's part of the problem. But technically, parts of it are plagiarized. That's just a factual statement. And you can, you know, I used to try to, there was a time when I thought, well, it's not really plagiarism because they're altering the words. But it's still plagiarism. And I'm not saying that.
What would you have had them do?
Look, just slow down.
What would you have had them do?
slow down. Keep things in context. Plagiarism is a word. It got its start in meaning regarding the inner association of human beings, not the inner association of celestial beings producing epical revelations for humanity. So we must start with the context for plagiarism when we attach these negative connotations to it.
May I address
that?
You can
say it's a fact that it's plagiarized, but that word has in the past only been used essentially for, you know, this type of human-to-human type of plagiarism where people take offense because you've taken something of mine and used it for your own purposes and not given credit. So, you know, I just feel like this undercurrent of you know, disparagement that is connoted by plagiarism is something that we fail to contextualize because the person making the criticism doesn't believe in the authenticity of the book. And this is the issue, is the authenticity of the book.
May
and
I chime
this
in?
This is the very issue that...
Let me just finish the thought.
Okay, not... And this is the issue with the academics.
We're running out of time, Halbert.
Okay.
And we'd like to allow our guests to...
Let's let Bob jump in here. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay. You know, earlier when I was talking about the water rights, I compared those to intellectual property rights. And so with respect to what Halbert said, I'd like to recontextualize things slightly. As the son of a career patent office employee, I know that you cannot patent an idea. You have to develop that idea in order to make it patentable. Secondly, we have countries that each have a billion people, and I'm referring to China and India, that have been resisting, you know, things like patent cooperation treaties and intellectual property law. And one of the reasons for that is in our own case law here in this country, if you wanted to invent something that would have been obvious to a person that was working on the same problem, you probably cannot get a patent for that invention. And so just because we're ahead of China and India when it comes to certain technologies, they're not necessarily going to respect our intellectual property rights with respect to those technologies. And it's not like, you know, it's just China and India. I mean, in our own case law, we have examples of where the intellectual property rights do not, you know, inure to the benefit of the inventor or the writer or anyone else. The Ascension University problem is, if we're going to comb through the curricula of thousands of colleges, looking for those things that are in the public domain so that we can deliver it in a $10 course rather than a $300 per credit hour course, we're going to basically run the risk whenever we're doing this advocacy for the public domain. But public librarians have been doing this for decades. They advocate for the public domain every day. And I think we need to study what they do. And it's going to be an important part of the FAD groups focused. And by that, I mean the Fact Acquisition and Dissemination Group, focus group within Ascension U on this intellectual property question. I look forward to having an in-depth discussion with Halbert this weekend. So.
Interesting. How much time do we have left?
We have about 10 minutes left, okay. And I have a question that I would like to ask Bob, and that is, have you spoken with or been in touch at all with David Nash?
Dan Amix in Florida emailed me about a month ago saying that he had spoken with Tim Hobbs about a project called the University Project. Now, I still don't know to this day if what he was referring to is the Urantia University. But
yes,
at one point, you know, Tim... Yeah, Tim had written me and asked if I was available for a conversation and at the end of the week, that week, and that was probably 6 weeks ago, and I said, sure. And I basically haven't heard from them since, even though I've written several times, so I don't know. You know, I just assume they were really busy with the, you know, FSUB conference in Florida and, you know, some upcoming conferences, so I'm sure... You know, I'm probably on their to-do list when it comes to callbacks, but probably not the highest priority at this point. So.
Okay.
We'll have a conversation.
And are you going to be Are you going to be at any of the summer conferences this year?
I don't really have the budget for that. I mean, I'd love to do it, but right now I work a 20-hour-a-week job so that I've got a steady flow of nickels and can focus on...
Well, let's see if we can get someone to get you a scholarship then.
Okay.
I'm actually somewhat serious about this.
Okay.
Yeah, seriously, well, yeah, I think it would be really great to get more people aware of what you're doing.
Okay, well... I'm certainly open to it, but right now my primary focus is getting the taxonomies blended and getting the prototypes done. And actually, you know, if anyone as a result of this narrowcast, you know, wants to explore what it would be like to be on one of these, you know, focus groups, it's just basically going to be a discussion board. And we'll have some conference calls and things like that related to it. But it'd be an easy way to be of service. In a way that could affect billions of people, I hope, if this pans out the way the vision I've been given suggests it will pan out. So.
Wonderful.
Wow.
Well, since we are in our last few minutes of the show, is there something that you would like to say, Bob, to sort of wrap things up?
Well, the first thing I want to say is, with respect to Urantia University, I see this as a complementary effort and not a competition. We're taking a very different approach, and I'm excited about Urantia University, and we'll probably end up enrolling in Urantia. I'm enrolled at Maryland University, so you know I intend to be enrolled in several. But I'm looking forward to what we can do in terms of collaboration. I'm also looking for a way to put the Urantia papers on Ascension University in the context of comparative religion courses, but using that wonderful technology that I have seen where the Paramony and the Urantia papers have kind of been integrated from a systems integration point of view, because I just think it would be a wonderful study aid, and I think it would be a great way to promote the Urantia papers within the context of Ascension University without necessarily being perceived as overtly Urantian.
Have you heard about the professor at Denison University in Ohio who has, in fact, added the Urantia book to her comparative religion curriculum?
Is that related to one of Halbert's efforts? Yeah, I've heard Halbert talk about that. Yes, I have heard about it. But, and I applaud what Halbert is doing as far as visiting all of the traditional universities that he can get into to do these presentations. That's also an important part. And there's three complementary efforts right there that are easy for us to identify, and I'm sure there are many, many more. If you have any other questions for me, I don't really have anything to say in terms of a wrap up. I'm just.
Did we get any other calls?
It's the same callers that we've had on the air. Chris, do you have any other last comments or questions to make for Bob?
I don't have another question quite for Bob. I didn't. I'm going to contact you, but I don't want to tell you that.
Sounds good.
I did have something to say about the whole plagiarism in the Bible. The people who've read the book. And don't, say it's plagiarized. I know we kind of got off that subject, but, I was reading, I've never read the Bible front and back, never read the Old Testament. I went to Catholic school, but, they kind of taught you the Old Testament. But if you look, this last week I was looking at one story about where the Bible says that Jesus killed a fig tree. And, I was trying to find in the Urantia book where it matched. Well, the story of when that happened, when the Bible says it happened, in the Bible, it's a couple sentences. And then you have, in the Urantia book, it's 3 pages long.
Right.
So it's not a matter of whether, the Bible served us well for 1,500 years. So, give or take. And both books are, the Urantia book was presented by celestial beings, but the Bible was written from what, it was written by human hand, it was written by human hand. And the Urantia book tells you. So it's not a matter of what is, the Urantia book tells you that it's basically stories written on sacred truths. It's a bunch of stories around real events that actually happened. And it's not as much as it's what you want to believe. You know, you can read the Bible and read, you know, two or three paragraphs and try to get that, you know, get the concept out of it. But if you read the Urantia book, whether, you know, it's a matter of faith, you know, it's a matter of just faith. You're not going to be able to wrap your whole mind around truth and everything. I mean, it's going to take you all the way until you get to Havana and beyond that, you know, it's for you to understand the whole thing. So it's a matter of faith. And if you have the faith to be able to read three or four pages and learn all those lessons that come from this one story, this one period of time when Jesus walked into the Jesus rode the ass into Jerusalem, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to read just a couple of stories, a couple of sentences that you know somebody wrote, you know, a few hundred, you know, 50, 60 years after it happened? Or do you want to read six or seven pages, not six or seven pages, but at least two pages worth of that same story, that same essence?
Right.
You know, whether it's
I agree with what you're saying, because the Urantia book greatly amplifies and often corrects what's in the Bible. And we only have, what, 5 minutes left, Crystalline?
No, we have about 2 minutes left.
Okay, let me just say that. I agree
with
what you're saying. I agree. What I was talking about is something that's completely different. It's an issue you may not know, may be aware of because you're a new reader. There are places in the Urantia book, a lot of places actually, where they directly take sentences from books that were written in the 1920s and 1930s by human authors, okay? And they don't just quote verbatim from the sources. They actually alter the words and change them around. But they tell us they do that. If you want to, I'd love to talk about this sometime off the air. But if you want to look at what I'm talking about, look at this. I think paper 120, I think it is, or 121 in part 4. The paper called The Times of Michael Bestole. At the end of that paper, there's an acknowledgement where the midwayer tells you what he did. Okay, and the midwayer tells you that he's been more of an editor than an original narrator, and he takes all kinds of human sources. I mean, there are all kinds of places where they actually will, you think it's Jesus talking, and they actually take a human source from the 1920s and 1930s and kind of alter the words. But anyway,
Andre,
we need to go, unfortunately.
We've got a minute left, and I just wanted to ask another final question of Bob from the board. What kind of time frame do you envision this project moving in?
Okay. The curriculum groups are building now. I'm recruiting, directors and trustees now. Jim Downs has already agreed to serve as a trustee for this project. We'll probably be recruiting teachers in mid-2010. We may have some courses that are actually being delivered before that time because we need to do prototyping, for one thing, and we'll try to do it, you know, with a course that's useful. The one thing that I would stress through all this is that in the spiritual disciplines arena, the way that's going to work is you will be able to make a value proposition, but we are trusting the Spirit of Truth to be of sufficient power to lead us into correct interpretations of what's presented there. That
20 seconds,
okay.
By the way.
Yeah, that's not a religious area. That is a area to work on the relationship that we have with God and to have a discussion where the Spirit of Truth will essentially be guiding us, and we'll hopefully be responsive to that as we're in that arena.
We're down to the wire here.
For people who are listening and want to contact Bob, just write to Andre, and he'll send you Bob's contact.
Or you can also just info at ascensionuniversities.org, right?
That's correct. And if you want to listen to the mini podcasts for the focus groups, they're at avia.com. That's AEVIA.com.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of